Oh, we're starting.
Well, no, I'm just setting it up because I'll forget. So
I played pickleball yesterday, and my arm is sore.
Oh,
so
did you have fun?
Yeah, it was super fun. The first time I did it, we went to indoor courts, and these were outdoor courts, and it was a beautiful day yesterday. So I was happy to be outside, but none of us actually know how to play the game. We know like the gist of the rules, but we don't really score, and that just doesn't work for me. If I'm going to play a game, you know, I was better this time. The first time I was like, no, I need to win.
Wait, I was saying it doesn't work for you because you need to score.
Yeah. Or yeah, I need to know that we're just like dicking around. And so like, because I knew that that's what was happening this time, I was fine.
Okay.
But if we're going to play the game, I want to play.
You
want to
play?
Yeah.
You want to play? Yeah, I understand. Yeah, I understand.
You know, I'm a huge advocate for listening to a podcast or a book at whatever speed you need to listen to, including my own. If you need to listen to Gaze Reading at 3x, do it, whatever, I don't care. But I never really say listen to the whole thing, but this episode, there's going to be so much at the end that I would just recommend, even like, just listen till the end is all I'll say. This episode is maybe our most chaotic. Yulin Kwong is our guest for her book, How to End a Love Story. And we're all on Pacific time. We recorded this at like 8 o'clock in the morning. I don't think I'd had coffee yet. Her internet was going in and out.
She had crazy internet.
It was sort of ridiculous. You know, most of our conversations last for about an hour. This one was like an hour and 40 minutes because it was just like constantly back and forth. So thanks to the magic of editing, you will not think that that's the case. But we do get a little slap happy because we're like, who knows what's going to happen in the world. For those of you who are new to us, thank you for joining Gaze Reading. For those coming back, thank you for coming back. And you've heard me say the spiel before, but I will just say, if you like what you're hearing, please share us with your friends. It is very helpful for us in terms of getting the word for Gaze Reading out there. You could find us at gazereading.com, on Instagram, at Gaze Reading. And wherever you listen to your podcasts. And speaking of, if you can subscribe or write us a review or give us 5 stars wherever you listen, that is also super duper helpful.
Last week we were at Ryan's school in Ohio, Kenyon, shout out to Kenyon. And anyway, one of the women who worked there came up to me and she said, I want you to know, she's like, I just listened to your podcast. She listened to the Bianca Bosker episode. And she was like, I loved it. And I ran right out and got the book. So that was nice. And always, it was nice.
It's so funny that that just happened to you because Brett Goldstein, another casting director, Brett, that we love, shout out to Brett. Hi, Brett. Thanks.
Hi, Brett.
She texted
love your
me.
Name.
She texted me this weekend with a screenshot of the Bianca Bosker episode and said, I'm obsessed with her. So that's Bianca Bosker getting a lot of love.
That's so funny. There's two books that come out today also that I just want to give a shout out to. Mm-hmm. One is Alan Bratton's Henry Henry, which is kind of an updated version of Shakespeare. And then the other thing is Indian Burial Ground by Nick Medina, which is a thriller. A man lunges in front of a car. An elderly woman silently drowns herself. A corpse sits up in its coffin and speaks. On this reservation, not all is what it seems in this new spine-chilling mythological horror from the author of Sisters of the Lost Nation. I have never read any Nick Medina. I don't know if you have, but it looks really interesting and it's a beautiful cover. So,
yeah. Also, this book came out a couple of weeks ago, but it only just got on my radar and I just got a copy of it. But it's called The Breakup Lists by Adeeb Khorram. I'm like 2 chapters in because I really wanted to read it. It's a YA boy meets boy story, and it's techies in high school theater, and I'm so excited to read it. It's so cute so far.
That is so right up your alley.
I know, it really is. I love it.
That was like written for you.
Today's guest is Yulin Kwong. Super cool. She is a screenwriter and director whose credits include The CW's I Ship It and Hulu's Dollface. She was fired from a Hallmark movie for being too hip for Hallmark and is the adapting screenwriter of Emily Henry's People We Meet on Vacation, as well as the writer-director of the forthcoming Beach Read film for 20th Century Studios. She lives in Pasadena with her husband, Zach, and their orange cat, Eloise, who we learn more about in the episode. I'm Jason.
I'm Brett.
and enjoy this episode of Gaze Reading.
Good morning.
Let me just make sure okay, we've got the microphone. We've got the headphone.
Yes.
All right. You guys,
Brett does the same thing every time.
I do, but I'm old.
Can I tell you all morning long that I'm really sorry about this, but I've been going back and forth between Eulene to the tune of Jolene.
Again, Cowboy Carter.
I think it's because of Cowboy Carter.
Correct.
And so all morning I've been like, Eulene. I've been so excited.
I'm thrilled, although I feel like Jolene she's got not a lot of places to hide after Cowboy Carter.
She was doing just fine before Cowboy Carter.
Yeah.
But then the other one this morning, which like I'm sure you don't get very often, and like why it's been in my head, I don't know, but it was Eulene, you learn.
Don't get that one a lot.
No, I'm sure you don't.
What is that?
That's Ernest Morissette.
Oh, you learn, I don't.
You learn, yeah. You change.
Oh, I wasn't an Alanis girly.
No, but you're a millennial. It was on the radio.
I know. But I wasn't very cool. I didn't. I grew up raised by parents who grew up in the People's Republic of China. And they really had this belief that pop culture was like a capitalist evil. And so anything that was popular, my parents were like instantly suspicious of. And so I feel like I ended up I can sacrifice music. I don't feel passionately about music. And instead I went towards like fan fiction. That's where my pop culture touchstones all were.
I was going to save this question for the end because it's on the list of things I want to talk to you about. And I want it.
My
we need
communist
to hear...
parents are.
No.
Takes a very different turn.
So in a minute, let's talk about your elevator pitch for How to End a Love Story.
Okay.
But let's put a pin in that for a second, because what I really want to hear the elevator pitch for is The Lost Treasure of Lisa Frank.
Oh, okay.
So that you, in your bio maybe, you talk about writing Lisa Frank fan fiction.
Yes.
I need to hear everything.
Have we already begun?
We're recording.
We are in media res. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's great. I feel like I should say for the record, my parents aren't communists in case the government is listening. No, right. It's fine. They're pharmaceutical research scientists, guys.
And I love them very much. Shout out to
my parents. So the Lisa Frank fan fiction was my second book.
Yes. 101 School Blues was first. I did my research.
Oh, wow. Wow. Thank you so much. I feel so important. Yes. That one was about like how important it is to go to school and like it. I can only assume I was grappling with themes of, I don't like going to school. And my parents were like, you will go and you will. Yes. There's like a girl turns into a monster because monsters don't go to school. I was like, this is actually elevated for a first grader.
It was like your Buffy world. My God.
Yes. So book two was The Lost Treasure of Lisa Frank. And it was very clearly me working through some issues of, so in my first grade and second grade, they combined the classrooms. There was first and second grade kids there. I had this friend, Elizabeth, who was like my bestie, and we were both in the same grade. And then when we were in second grade, this new girl, Jessica, arrived on the scene. She was a first grader who was young, Eulene would like to say, infiltrating our friend group. And I did not like that. Anyway, so I was working through these feelings in my Lisa Frank fan fiction, where it was these three unicorns. They were going to go, there was a map and they were like, okay, we're going to go find the treasure. And there's a line in there that's these two unicorns were flying. And then there was this third one that couldn't fly as high. And like throughout the entire book, it's this kind of like me doing like subtle fuck yous to Jessica. But that's the plot of The Lost. I think find the treasure. But
God.
The real story is about the friendship dynamics that I was trying to unpack.
Do we still talk to Jessica? Are you aware of her now?
No, because I moved from Wichita when I was 8 in 1998. And so the internet didn't really exist at that point in time. And there are all of these friendships that like I had that I just haven't been able to, I don't know. I'm like, I would love to talk about them more in case.
Her here today. Jessica, can you come out, please?
Jessica, Wichita, Kansas. Yeah. I have some apologies to make.
That's so funny. In our episode that actually drops today, we talked to Douglas Westerbeek about relationships that you have had on your journey that you like, that have had an impact on you, but you never are with ever again. And that's Jessica for you.
Those touchstones.
Yeah, I would say Elizabeth Moore. I named my diary after her. But yeah, but Jessica was also there. I don't know. Yeah. There were a lot of friendships. I moved a ton because my parents had this thing where every year they would look up the best public school in the area for my incoming grade. And then they would move us into that district.
Because of that.
And it was unhinged. It was crazy, guys. I don't recommend it because it gives your kids like extreme attachment issues.
Seriously.
So my path is littered with Jessicas. There's also a Jamie. She was like my first editor. She read my Pearl Harbor book. That was my next book that I was like fifth or sixth grade, I think. Okay. And she read that one and she told me it was like boring and slow. And so I changed my entire, I abandoned that effort and I started a new book. And I think about her often too, because I'm like, where are you, Jamie of Union, New Jersey?
Well, and maybe if Jamie liked your Pearl Harbor book, you would have written historical fictions.
I know. She was right though, because the date that will live in infamy was December 7th, 1941. And it was, I modeled it off of the Dear America books. And so where they were like diary entries. And so I started it in like June 1938. And so it was too boring and slow, but it's what it is.
I don't care about your life, Eileen. Stop.
I want these people to find you now. That's what's interesting to me with the publication of the book and the Jamie or Julia. They're sitting somewhere and they're like, I have to reach out. I wonder if she ever thinks of me.
I think about you all the time.
If one of you is listening to this episode, email us at gazereading@gmail.com.
Yes, exactly.
So we have Jamie to thank for taking historical fiction out of your repertoire, and you have found a path to rom-coms.
Contemporaries, yes.
What is your elevator pitch for How to End a Love Story?
The elevator pitch for this is, it's about a screenwriter and a novelist, and they are connected by some very tragic events that happened 13 years prior when they were in high school. He was the homecoming king, class president, and she was the editor-in-chief of the school paper, overachiever type. And then one night, her younger sister dies by suicide by walking into traffic. And he is the one that is driving the car that hits her. And he shows up to the funeral. He's very promptly ejected. We don't want you here. And then 13 years later, she is a YA novelist, and her books are being adapted for television. And he is a screenwriter, and he is the number two in the writer's room that is doing the adaptation.
You talk about romance books, like earlier romance books, as a catalyst for you falling in love with the genre. How did you get into those?
In seventh grade, this girl, Kathy, in my homeroom class had this book, and I could tell it was like not like other books. It had this blue cover and these swoopy gold letters, and it was Halfway to Heaven by Susan Wiggs, which is a historical. That awakened something within me. And I was like, wow, what am I feeling? What am I experiencing? And so I read the sequel. There's a sequel with the sister. And I was like, this is a complete set. I can sense it's not a safe place for me to continue down this road because it'll awaken something within me that I am not ready to examine. And so I carried on with fan fiction for many years. And then in the year 2016, I was looking for escapism in literature for some reason. And I remembered that feeling across time.
Something that is addressed in your book is that it is not having that awkward teen phase. And Helen complains to Grant that he didn't have that awkward teen phase that forced him to develop a rich interior life to compensate.
Yes.
I feel like this is what you're describing, that you did have that rich interior life.
I sure did. I didn't have a lot going on in my exterior life, guys. I had piano lessons on Fridays at 7 p.m. every day of middle school through high school. And I think it's because my parents were like, if we let her out into the world, she'll, I don't know, get into trouble. And so instead, I was raised like a quaint Victorian child and just sat in my room thinking about the things I would do if I could only do them.
And now you have this weird closet of dresses.
And yeah, journals.
Strange. And journals, so many
journals.
Because
you were a big journalist, and you still journal, correct?
I do. I like to write down all my thoughts so that they don't all end up on the page.
Do you have a in-case-of-death game plan for them?
I don't know. Roll the dice. I won't be around. Publish them if you want. My sister, I have a much younger sister. She's 14 years younger. She and I did this weird bonding thing last summer where she came to visit. We didn't set out to do this. I was going to like take her around LA, but then I fell ill with COVID. And so we read through all of my middle school and high school diaries. She wanted to know what it was like when she was first born, which was when I was 14.
Oh, wow.
And I was like deeply resentful of her birth. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, it's been over 10 years since all of this happened. I obviously don't feel this way anymore. So yeah, why don't we take a look back, roll back the time machine and see what the Kwong household was like when you first came into the world.
And it was the hormones raging at the time.
And
too.
The hormones raging. She got very into like certain love triangles of like very nerdy circles of my seventh grade class. And it was like it was probably one of the more meaningful things I've done in my life, bizarrely. We called it the great catch up because it was this first time where it was like she was my teenage sister was reading my teenage words. And usually when you have that big age gap, you can't close it because you're never at the same stage of life at the same time. But because we had these diaries, I felt like much closer to her at the end of it. And it was very strange.
And she was able to then experience that through you.
Yes. And also like connect on a level of, our parents, this is how our parents changed and this is how they stayed the same when they were raising her. And so it was an interesting, I don't know, should be studied in child psychology.
Her perception and your perception of how things were. It's crazy. That's really great.
I love that. I know. I was very much an indoor kid.
I call it being an inside girl. I was an inside girl. At a certain point when all the kids are playing outside and then you go inside and you just don't come out again. Is that what you mean when you say you were an indoor kid?
Oh, yeah. And also just I would write plays and watch movies and
what were your plays about?
There was an adaptation of Snow White. There was this nice Jewish boy wrote an adaptation of A Christmas Carol. But the one that I'm kicking myself about is I started writing this thing that I called Wheels with a Z at the end. It was like my take on Starlight Express, where everyone was going to be on rollerblades. The idea was it's the wheels inside your head. And it was an early version of what would be Inside Out. And I was like, if I actually created this,
multi-million dollar idea. Okay, what I'm curious about, because I too did a Christmas Carol adaptation in my fan fiction days. And that was as a kid who, we were in Wichita, Kansas for 5 years. So there was an evangelical bent for a while. And then we moved to New Jersey and my parents put me in Catholic school for a year, which was an inoculation. It was like, never mind about all of that. This overdose on religion and maybe you won't
good
be
God.
A
good
but from that, I also found A Christmas Carol. So I'm very curious, what drew you to that story, Jason?
I think I had seen other theatrical adaptations of it. And I was also aware of the concept of public domain.
And so savvy.
Yeah, that's why it was like, okay, I could do a fairy tale. I could do A Christmas Carol. Yes. And I think it was that simple. I don't know if I liked the idea of like transformation and just like changing for the better and learning empathy. Maybe that's like a big theme in my life is I appreciate people who can put themselves in other people's shoes and then change for the better.
Oh, maybe. That's nice. Mine was James Potter it was Marauders Era fanfic. And he had become like jaded and cynical. And for some reason, that was really my id. I was like, show me a jaded, cynical man and let's take him on a journey, which is not the hero in How to End a Love Story like at all. I would not say he is jaded and cynical, but maybe I should write a jaded and cynical man for another book.
And what softens him? That completely is it. Who's that special woman that is the...
Or three ghosts.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Ghosts of women past or men past or whatever.
Exactly.
It's also funny just thinking about like the past and the way that Grant was this sort of ideal person to Helen when she was in high school. Looking back on my high school experience, most people that were the prom king or homecoming king or whatever, that was where they peaked.
They peaked, yeah.
And I'm grateful to have not felt that, even though I was jealous of them when I was a kid.
Yes.
I'm sort of glad that wasn't me then.
Have you ever gone back to a reunion?
Yes, I did. And I got blackout wasted at my 10-year high school reunion and had to be broken out of the bathroom and then taken to the hospital where I was given I was repressing some memories, I think.
You really were.
Was this before or after you reread the journals?
This was before. This was before. This was in the year 2018.
Oh, my God.
And for anybody who was at the Watchung Hills High School reunion in New Jersey that year, I have many apologies to issue. Jessica, wow. I'm sure I said weird things to you.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, I always wanted to, I would never go back because I had a horrible high school experience. Like, middle and high school was awful for me. And I was bullied mercilessly. But enough that you always, you remember that person, you know what I mean?
And your body remembers, yeah.
Your body remembers who those people are and what they are. And it is trauma in a lot of ways that I'm, 56 years old and I still remember, Brian O'Korn, who traumatized me and, captain of the wrestling team. And it was awful all these years later.
Yeah.
And if I said to you that I have gone down a deep dive on Facebook and looked him up and seen what he looks like now, but it's exactly what you said, Jason, where there is this little bit of schadenfreude of, y'all peaked. And I feel, but I don't know that I could ever go back. I don't know that I literally could stand in a room and it's what you create in your mind. It's so big and probably for all those people it was nothing. It was just them being dicks or whatever.
Social media has changed that too.
Sure.
I think being able to see these humans in that way, you don't have to face it. Yeah.
Yes. It fulfills that scratch where you're like, okay, that person, I wouldn't trade my life for theirs.
Not at all. Not at all. Ah. It feels so you,
but I wish I could obliterate that memory from all of the class of 2008.
But what's interesting you mean that memory of you being at the reunion?
Yeah.
Though what's interesting is you go on to talk about spinning personal wounds into gold. Mm-hmm. And why do you think why is that an easier place to start? Or is it your way of dealing with that trauma? Is it your...
I have to believe all this emotional cutting is worth something. I feel like I have always examined what I felt like were the ugly things in my brain that I couldn't quite see, or I didn't have the language, or I felt like too ashamed to deal with it in regular life. And this goes back to the Lisa Frank fan fiction, right? Those were my ugly feelings about a friendship dynamic that I put into this story. And so I think that has always come naturally to me, is looking at the things that I feel slight shame about and then just go opening a vein and saying, what's that going
to
do?
And that said, and related to reunions, Helen's least favorite thing about herself is that she cares about what other people think.
Mm. Oh, yeah, I do.
Relatable.
I abhor how much I care. Oh. It's terrible. Because I would love to be a real free spirit artist that's fuck you to the man and all these things. But I'm no, I really care. I really care about how you perceive me. You can hurt me so easy.
Yeah, it's funny. I was just telling Brett my birthday is Saturday and I hate getting the attention. And yet if people don't wish me a happy birthday, I don't want to say I feel offended, but I also feel unworthy of the...
Absolutely.
But even though I really don't want it.
Yes.
Yeah, no, that's
my
exactly
birthday
right.
is on Friday. So we're one
Whoa,
after another.
Look at that.
And is this an Aries thing? I don't know astrology. Yeah,
maybe.
No, I feel the either. Exact same way.
Let's say it's an Aries thing.
Yeah.
It's also a Sag thing, you guys. It's also a Sag thing.
Okay. Yeah, it's great. Okay. You can be included too.
Yeah. I go by Enneagrams because I find them useful when I'm constructing a character to give them an Enneagram, because that one is a personality typing thing that tells you what they're like when they're healthy and what they're like when they're unhealthy. Mm. And I find that helpful during a three-act structure to be like, okay, what are you like at your most toxic? And that's what you'll be like in act three. And that's fun. So I gave Helen my Enneagram type, which is Enneagram 3, the Achiever, who cares deeply about how others perceive her.
That's interesting. Do you think that's something we can grow out of, or that's just who we are?
I think you can. I think, first of all, personality typing is bullshit and your people are complex. But we also love to categorize. And you should be any quiz and I'm like, yes, which one am I? And so it's, yeah, I do know people who have changed their Enneagram types over the years because I keep this notes app on my phone of like my friend's Enneagram types so that if I choose a certain type of Enneagram for a character, I can look at my little notes app and be like, okay, which friends am I?
Interesting.
How would this friend react in the world? But I have some friends who were like, before this traumatic thing happened to me, I was a 8. And then after this thing happened, I became a 1. And I'm like, that's so interesting. Trauma changes you.
Yeah. No, I.
But really maybe growth does that. Too.
Sure. No, I think a lot. There Absolutely. Are. I think that the idea of just like outside forces, whether it's trauma or growth or just change in general, what that means and how we then respond to it.
Yes.
Fascinating. We should all do our Enneagram.
Oh my God, I would love to know what you guys are.
Right, let's do it. We'll do it. And we'll.
I think we'll do it because I've
when
never.
When we air this episode, we'll talk about it.
Yes. It is the longest quiz. It is the longest personality quiz in the world. And it's questions that, it's different from the attachment styles quiz, which was more like, how's your relationship with your mom? And I was like, laughs for 5 minutes. But
let me go back to journal number 17.
No, but speaking of that, I love that element of the book that you had this relationship that she had this relationship with her parents. Talk a little bit about that, because that is such a great, with both of them, but especially with her mother, which she refers to as a prickly, complicated love.
Yes, it is.
You obviously can relate.
To tell a story that felt emotionally true. And I think this was maybe coming off of a reaction. I was extremely online in the 2010s. And so I was on Tumblr absorbing a lot of conversations about good representation. And at the time, it felt like a lot of it was around the idea, we want to move away from stereotypes. Asians get so much model minority rap, and that's actually a bad thing. It's a trap, and it is a trap. But the answer became, oh, we have to show people who are flunking and like stoner Asians and Asians with good relationships with their parents. And I was like, trying to write those. And none of those movies got made. But so I wrote this book because I was like, what story would I tell if I didn't have to convince anybody to let me tell it first? Because maybe nobody will ever see it. So the stakes are like me. What will please me? And I was like, I am a mentally ill, high achieving Asian. So let's just turn that lens inward a little bit and see how we got here, you know?
Like, I took the quiz about it. It's official.
Right. It's real, yeah.
I can give you facts and numbers.
Exactly. And so I was like, what does that actually look like? Because I think I just wanted to explore what that was, what made me the way I am, and then maybe push it a little bit even more in a more toxic direction. And this is what came out.
Oddly, I don't think it reads as toxic as you might think it is.
Oh, good.
Like, I think it's, certainly it's toxic, but I think it's relatable. I don't think it's as far as you think it is.
No, whatever I also that's think worth. It, like, it's complex.
My mom will love hearing that.
Yes.
So much of the book is a rom-com, but also this, like, meditation on adolescence and what we go through when we're young and our parents and peer pressure. And there's so much. I couldn't believe how much I related to so much of what Helen was saying about her childhood or her coming of age time. I was like, I give into peer pressure still too. Like, it's a thing.
Yeah.
It's powerful.
And what I loved, what I really, and I said this to Jason early on, because he knows I'm not a rom-com person generally, although I love watching them. I love a rom-com movie, especially like the older stuff. But I have to say what I loved about this for me is because you were handling all these different things. And it wasn't, there is a central love story, of course, and like the will there, won't be, and what's set up. But it is because of all these other things. It was the relationship with her family. It was the fact that you launched this thing with a horrible incident that takes place that made it much more complex. So that is what I really appreciated about it. And that's why, like, it works. And I will say that to people who may not normally gravitate towards a romance or a rom-com, that this is something that I think they could.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's very much on brand for me. And so when I heard from Brett that he was loving it, I was like, yes, that means it's really good.
That makes me so happy because I really did want to please both audiences here a little bit, where I think there are just people who love romance, right? And I think that's the bucket that I fall in. But I think that sometimes Hollywood can flatten the term rom-com into just like kissing and jokes. And so that's when you get those kind of like low stakes, oh no, we're stuck in a bake-off or something like that. And those movies should exist. Like, I don't think everything should be like heavy and awful all the time. But I do think, when you talk about Sleepless in Seattle, that's a movie that begins with great suffering. This is a kid calling in to a radio station to be like, my dad needs a new wife because he's really sad. And I think that the best romances can take you on that emotional journey from like the depths of sadness and end in a place that's hopeful. And I don't know, I really feel strongly that is what romance should be.
And I will say, listen, the cover is adorable. It's beautiful. But there, I've interviewed a cover designer before, and she's talked a lot about how it's part of her job is getting it on a shelf next to books that will inspire people to pick up that book too. And I look forward to people who wouldn't usually pick this up on the shelf, pick it up because everyone's saying you should pick it up anyway.
Yes. We had quite a journey with this cover, I will say. We had a different cover that was like approved and made it to apparently some galleys. Like, somebody tagged me on Instagram. It was, let me see if I can, I don't know. Is this okay for me to show you?
Sure. Yeah.
I feel like it's public. Let's tell
you.
You
tell us.
Yeah. So it was like, so this was the original cover. It was more of a, I would describe it as like a Rebecca Searle painterly cover,
yes,
where it's Los Angeles, hillside, Silver Lake Hills. And then there was like blue and pink clouds. And it was very kind of simple and minimalist. There were no people on this cover. And I really loved this cover.
I gotta be honest, so did my editor.
Yeah, I loved it too. My editor loved it. My agent loved it. I loved it. And then sales said no. Pale said that you couldn't really tell what the book was about. And they were right.
They were right.
Yeah. Like, you look at that cover and you go, okay, I think maybe it's set in a place with palm trees and houses, and makes me sad, but also I understand. And that's the tension. I call it the Alpha Bug Linda tension, where at my core, I want to be a green witch who's, I'm in it for the art. And then somebody has to be like, I will make you popular. And that's how we ended up with the very pink cover.
I can't believe we just got a witch reading.
Oh my God, you're so on brand. Shout out. God, we should have a sing-along.
You're like, I just wanted to defy gravity.
Yeah.
I did.
And yet no good deed goes unpunished.
But something has changed within you.
Oh my God.
Something in your anagram.
Oh, that's so interesting. What
fascinating
inside scoop. Okay, you, in talking about rom-coms, you just gave an example of getting stuck in a bake-off.
Yes.
There is something that I could have brought up at the beginning, and we probably could have talked about this for an entire hour. Something that is mentioned in the book is Grant has very specific feelings about watching Bake Off, because he says, what is the point if you can't taste the food? And
true.
I, first of all, I can relate to that so deeply, because that's why I don't like watching Top Chef.
Yes.
But Bake Off, it's a lot more about personalities and a vibe.
Yes.
How do you feel about this?
I agree with you. I agree with you that it is much more about the personalities and the vibes. However, I don't think Grant developed the rich interior life that you and I did, Jason. He's an outdoor kid. He didn't download seasons upon seasons of Bake Off and watch them all. No, he was out there
catching a ball
in the real world. Catching a ball.
Running track.
Drinking beers.
I wish there was the Top Chef restaurant where you can taste dishes that were like made famous on Top Chef.
They do it in LA. It's a whole thing. They did it last year for when we got
Yulene and I are going.
let's go.
For your consideration, Netflix did this whole thing where they had 10 of the chefs, and you would go to, it's like a Netflix restaurant with all the chefs preparing their different dishes.
Maybe
they'll do it again this year, because it was done around, for your consideration, that they set up this thing.
Yeah, but that's very exclusive.
It's very exclusive, but Grant probably has access to those things.
I'm not talking about Grant, I'm talking about me.
I know. You and me. We could probably, I feel
you
like.
You could drive up. It's just
between
medical reservation.
The three of us.
I actually looked it up. Like, you went to the website, made a reservation. It was like going to Open Table. And so, yeah, maybe they'll do it again.
I think we could wrangle an invite between the three of us.
They could do that as a rotating, they could do that all year round.
This is what I'm saying.
They ought.
But isn't the premise of Top Chef like they'll get their own restaurant?
And so most of them do. So many of them are here.
I know, yes. But it should be someone essentially doing like a, not a knockoff, because that's not, but using the recipe and just cook and making it, right? Yes, it's not like.
I feel like you could maybe get all the losers of Top Chef.
I literally just almost took a spit take.
I know you did. And by the way, I don't know, that's a draw for people. Come taste the loser's food.
Well, no, it's like the top five.
I would go. I would go.
No, I would go too. It's still better than my cooking.
Because then the winners got their own restaurant, right?
You call, yeah, you call the restaurant.
They're not available.
And you'd call it runners up.
Or not Top Chef.
Because the runners who take the food out, so it all's like,
yeah, no. I feel something in my body when you say the runners up. Like when I feel like going into that restaurant would make me feel not about myself. Mm-hmm.
To close the loop on Bake Off / you making a Wicked reference, I just want you to know that there is a Great British Bake Off musical.
Oh.
It started in the Edinburgh Fringe. And there's a cast recording of it on Spotify that you could listen to the songs. It is so cute. And if you're a fan, I think you'll appreciate
what's
it.
What's it called?
So that's my PSA. It's literally called The Great British Bake Off Musical.
Wow.
And wait, is it Paul Hollywood and Mary Berry, or is it the crew and who are the hosts?
They are fictional hosts.
Oh, yeah. But are they playing those ones or are they not? Playing those, are they like they've made up totally new ones?
Yes, it is a fictionalized version of Paul Hollywood. It's like Joe Starstruck.
Got it.
Right. Something like that. But it's so cute and it's authorized. And so the theme music that you hear, they like set lyrics to it. And anyway, it's adorable. Highly recommend.
I will be checking that out later today.
Did they do like Waitress when you went and you could buy pies in the theater? They'd come down with like trolleys during intermission with all these different little pies you could buy, which were like mid, but it did smell amazing.
I appreciate that Brett says mid because he has teenage children. And
that's where I get all of my vernacular.
All your references?
Sus. Like my daughter's always saying these things and I'm like, what does that mean? The latest thing is edging. And I was like, wait, does that mean what I think it means?
Inappropriate.
Yes, and I said that too, but it doesn't mean that. It just means like, so she's like, what do you think
it means?
What does
it mean? Brett.
She's like, oh, it's so edging. And so she's, it's so edging. And so I was like, what does that mean? I almost want to call her in.
You're being taken for a ride because edging means.
I know what it means.
What we think it means.
It would be
I'm looking it up on Urban Dictionary right now.
It would pertain to how to end a love story, some of these scenes.
That is true. Emily Henry told me that my book was edging as the book. And that was, I didn't need another blurb after that.
Wait, let's get into that for 1 second, because I'm going to move off this with my daughter because it's awkward. And to wait, to just say, so how did that come into your realm? All of this with Emily Henry, how did that all happen?
Her books were sent to me for consideration. So it was, we were match made by our respective industries where it was this person and this person. We think you guys would do well together. And I know there were other people up for those jobs as well. Mm. So they lobbed her manuscripts into the email inboxes of several screenwriters. And I was one of the ones that said yes. And then luckily she said yes to me back. That mutual selection process worked out. And then we sold People Leave Me on Vacation first. And I adapted that one just as a screenwriter. We got Brett Haley attached to direct it. And then they came back to me and they said, do you want to do Beach Read, but also as the filmmaker? And I was like, yes.
Amazing.
Well, actually, I said I wanted to do it as only if I could also direct it. And luckily, they said yes. And yes. So that is how that came to be.
How fun. So I'm obsessed that what you described is basically like dating. You said yes, and then she said yes, and then you fell in love and lived happily ever after. Which leads me to, we have to talk about dating because there is something that happens in the book. How much do I want to give away? But we're spoiler free. This is not a spoiler, but let's just say someone gets asked on a first date by using a Google form.
Yes.
And I don't want to give away more than that, but are there unique ways that you were asked out on a date or that something creative happened?
That's so nice that you
happened?
Think people asked me out on dates.
Well, you're married now, so something had to, there was a...
Something did happen. The piano tuners have arrived. I just want to tell you, in case you hear piano keys happening.
I thought that was the beginning of your story.
I did too.
Piano tuners have arrived. Now he's my husband.
My husband and I met in college. He was studying art and I was studying creative writing and international relations and politics, because for a brief moment in time, I thought that I wanted to become a White House press correspondent because I had watched so much of The West Wing and also Gilmore Girls. But that was not to be. So I kept writing all these screenplays and handing them off to other people to direct. And then they kept fucking it up. So I was like, I'm going to do it. And so I stayed over spring break to shoot this short film that was about my breakup. I had recently gone through a breakup. And my cinematographer was a girl from the local film school at Point Park, but she became an RA. And so she was no longer available. So I got off the phone with her and I cried. And then I walked into the hallway. And in my memory, Zach is wearing a camera around his neck. Unbeknownst to me at that point in time, he had also been dumped by his girlfriend. And his friends and his ex-girlfriend were all in Florida on spring break. And he had stayed behind, not going to that trip. Anyway, I was like, Zach, you know how to use a camera. And he said, yes, I do. And I said, will you shoot this short film for me? And he said, yes. And then he started sending me these very highbrow, obscure references for my little short film. So he was like, have you seen La Jetée? And I was like, no, I haven't seen La Jetée. It's a photo roman. What does that even mean? And I watched it and I was like, wow, this is so deep. This is like a bunch of film nerds flirt. And he was like, oh, you should really watch The Royal Tenenbaums. And I was like, what's that? He introduced me to my first Wes Anderson proper, I think. And so I was really impressed with him. God, I'm so easy. Just show her some French New Wave in a Wes Anderson film and she's just there. She's ready.
She melts. But I'm sorry. I asked you about like creative ways of that romance spark. I guess I didn't quite say it that succinctly, but you have that. How dare you? You do, don't take do that away from yourself.
Yes, you're right. I do have that. That was my dating. That was my dating. And then we broke up. We broke up for basically my senior year. He was a year older than me. He was, I'm going to stay behind, not for you, but I'm going to be in Pittsburgh because he was from Pittsburgh as well. Mm. And I was like, I'm going to move to New York. And he was like, I'm going to move to New York. And then I was like, actually, I'm going to move to LA. And he was like, I'll move to LA too. And I was like, this is too much pressure. So I imploded it. And then we moved out to LA. And then we had these friends who were like, do you want to live with us? And they didn't know Zach and I had previously dated. So we both looked at each other and played this game of chicken where we were like, I'm not going to not live here because of you. So we moved into the same apartment and we were like sharing a wall while we were broken up. And I was dating somebody long distance as well. It was a whole, that was a whole saga. But then we got back together.
This novel's sitting in your drawer.
Seriously.
Somewhere.
Right? Somewhere. I'm waiting. It's a working title whenever you're ready. I'm not yet ready to sell that one.
Oh my God. I know. Seriously. If they say write what you know, but also you're like, wait a minute. That's too, I know too much.
We got to save some things. Do I want to see Goodreads reviewers telling me that my love declaration is stilted and awkward? We've got to save some things for reality.
It's funny, you saying stilted and awkward and like thinking of the Google form and the small romantic gesture to get someone to go on a date with you. It was, what, March 2017 when they said like the Mayan calendar was going to end and the world was going to end?
Yeah.
Something. Oh, not 2017. It was like 2012, something like that.
Oh, yeah.
It was before I met my husband, and I met him in 2014. So it was before that.
No, true love. I'm going to die.
So I sent an email to a friend who I was, we were like hanging out a lot and going to dinners and doing activities. We were basically going on dates. And I sent an email that was like, if the world is actually going to end, I don't want to not ask you out on a date. So can we go out on a separate date?
That's beautiful.
No,
that's so great. The stakes are super high too. That's a good movie.
That is. Yeah. You had me at hello. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. That's so sweet.
I know. And then it like didn't. It was a bad experience. It was like should not have crossed that line. And that was, he said yes, but then I was just like, oh wait, this was a mistake. And then it was a bad thing. But,
so it didn't.
And then you
work.
Were like, let
so
it all like... in now. Bring on the
but
meteor.
Then I met my husband. I was sitting next to him on a plane. And that's how we met. So I was like, okay, I got my meet cute that I wanted. I'm never going to find a better meet cute. So I have to
that's
stop.
That's very Nora Ephron approved.
Yes. Like, so Nora Ephron. When we got back to New York and it was winter and we were in our winter coats and meeting up for the first time again on Houston and Lafayette was like, that was like the peak Nora Ephron moment. So anyway.
Beautiful. I love that.
Do you have a favorite, whether it's Nora Ephron or like
favorite,
a favorite rom-com?
A favorite rom-com. I have a lot. I try to, I try not to anchor too much to the 90s rom-coms just because everybody loves them so much, and I agree. But I think if we keep trying to make them over and over again, the art form will never push forward. And the thing I always try to remember is that film is possibly one of the newest art forms that exists. It's like less than 100 years old. And so we can't possibly have exhausted all that the rom-com is capable of in the 90s. However, favorite romances. Okay. There's a 1920s silent film called Sunrise that is a very bizarre premise. And it won like an Oscar for artistic excellence back in the 20s. So that's if we're looking at the very beginning. And then one of my favorites that is more recent, there's one, I think it's called, my French is horrible, Hors de Prix. I want to say it's like Audrey Tautou. It's a French film. She plays a gold digger who is like up at this hotel. She's with a much older man. And then on her birthday, that guy like falls asleep. And so she's like, okay, I'll seduce a young hot millionaire. And she does. But it turns out that guy's actually the barman. And then her kind of sugar daddy is, he breaks their engagement because he's found out that she's cheated on him. So then she tries to run off with the barman, but then she finds out he's got not a cent to his name. And then that man becomes like a kept man to an older woman at the hotel so that he can keep up with Audrey as she's like trying to find her next sugar daddy. And then it's like this very French kind of sex comedy, but also like deep and profound. And it's about these two people who are searching for connection and a sense of stability. I love it. I think the English translation is priceless, but it's one of my favorite rom-coms.
I appreciate that you're giving credit to the non-90s rom-coms, because there is more than that. Just for the sake of documenting it, I will say, shout out to You've Got Mail. It is deeply rooted in who I am.
It is great. And okay, here's an underrated 90s rom-com that I loved so much that I put it in my fanfiction.
I'm curious if we're going to say the same one.
It was Runaway Bride, and it was not...
Oh, interesting.
It doesn't exactly hold up. I don't know that it exactly holds up. But Richard Gere is so charming.
He's
in that.
Oh, my God.
He is so good. And like his chemistry with Julia Roberts, obviously phenomenal. We've already talked about Pretty Woman. This is their lesser known sequel. Not sequel, but like reteam.
Right.
There's this part where he like rolls out from under a car and his heart, man, is great. He has a cat named Italics. And I was convinced for so long that when I got a cat, I would name it. I named my cat Eloise after Eloise at the Plaza. But a lot of people on Goodreads think I use too many italics in my book. So it's like an homage to Richard Gere in Runaway Bride.
Funny. For me, my underrated 90s rom-com is Must Love Dogs.
Ooh,
I don't know why.
I know that one.
It's Diane Lane and John Cusack and Christopher Plummer and Stocker Channing. And it's so random, but I love it. And
is Christopher Plummer in a romantic storyline?
Yes. He's not the lead, but he does have a romantic secondary plot. It's probably terrible. It's like a 20% on
I would be interested to see what you think of it now, like just with life, what you would
say. It's sweet. It's something to have on while you're doing the dishes. Like,
yeah.
He's inspired me to reach out and broaden my horizons of other.
See, I loved all those working title films, like Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yes.
Like Notting Hill, I was obsessed with.
Oh, no.
Like, so good.
And then, of course, Jerry Maguire, just because that whole thing followed like a baby. I'm just a girl.
So
that was Julie Roberts. That's Notting Hill when she says, I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love me.
But Jerry Maguire has one of the best meet cutes because they're like an Insta family where it's like Tom Cruise and Renee Zellweger and they're holding the kids' hands.
Oh, my God.
And he's linked to them and he's looking up at them and it's so cute.
I just want to say also shouting out to OG playwrights who then had their plays adapted into movies like Cactus Flower and Barefoot in the Park. They're fantastic
movies.
Barefoot
in the Park.
Great rom-coms. They're great plays. And Cactus Flower, if you've never seen Cactus Flower, so good. It's Goldie Hawn's debut. Fantastic. Highly recommend.
She's
again,
another one.
Like these, like
Butterflies Are Free. That was another one with Goldie Hawn. Do you know Butterflies Are Free? Where she plays this flighty girl and she meets this guy who lives on another floor, who's Paul, who's very uptight.
It's a play.
Yes. Yes.
Play first.
Yeah. I love a play. I need to see more plays.
So we've been talking ad nauseum about our favorite rom-coms. And something that comes up in the book is the concept of living out someone else's rom-com. And how do you think one can stay the main character of their own story?
I feel like that's such a theme even in rom-coms, right? To feel like you're not the main character, you're the side character. So sometimes I wonder if people who are like, I just don't feel like I'm the main character of my own life. Are you on a different level? Like you're like, I'm so like the main character that I've lost myself in the performance. But in terms of all that, I think it's just a matter of knowing what you want and going for it, right? That's what a protagonist does, I think. I love writing about like obsessive, hungry, ambitious women, probably because that's who I am. And I think that it's harder to get stuck with those characters because they know what they want. And if they feel stuck for some reason, they'll find a way out. And I think that can be inspiring. Don't take it too far. Don't accidentally land in a psychological horror. But having a healthy dose of self-determination.
I've never really thought about it like that. But the idea of knowing what you want and going for it. When I was living in New York, I had so many people who were like, oh, I wish I could do it. I'm jealous of you. And I would always be like, girl, move. Understand that life is hard. But like, if that's a dream of yours, do it. And I think suddenly it's easier to feel like you can have main character energy when you are being bold and making those choices. And if you're not, you're like watching life happen around you. And maybe you are in turn not feeling like a main character. Grant talks towards the end of the book, again, not a spoiler, just this is who he is as a character, that he's had the kind of career that if his 22-year-old self went to his IMDb page, he could drop dead tomorrow knowing that he's achieved his life ambitions. I have one tattoo and I got it when I left college. And the point of me getting it was to never forget where I came from and never forget what sort of those initial dreams were. And I always reflect back and just think, have I hit those milestones? And yes, continue to grow and continue to aspire for greatness, but don't forget that like you did it, you know? Yeah. And I think we all can have a little refresher of that.
Yes. Remember, look how far you've come.
Yeah. Yeah. In general. We're very excited for you, Yulene.
It's amazing.
Yulene. You're getting that so much lately, I'm sure. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, it introduced me to Dolly at an earlier age. The fact that people would sing that. Yeah.
Look at me being so on the nose. Embarrassing.
No, it's good. I like it.
Congratulations on the book and all of the things that are happening in your world. I hope that your 22-year-old self.
She would be thrilled to see where I am now. And she would also probably write like the Christmas Carol fanfic where I'm jaded and cynical now. And yes. I need people to pull me back to myself.
I can't wait to read your adaptation. Amazing. And this has been such a pleasure.
Lovely.
Happy birthday.
Yes. Thank you. Happy birthday to you.
Birthday twins. Thank you.
So you Aries fun. Kids.
Yulene, thank you for being here.
Thank you for that fun roller coaster of our conversation.
Roller coaster. A few things to say. Thing one, not that we do like fact checking on the show, but I just was curious to look, and Must Love Dogs has 37% on Rotten Tomatoes. I said 20%. It's a little bit better than I thought. It's still very charming, and I still agree that it's a good movie to have on when you're like washing the dishes or folding laundry. It's very sweet. I also think we can post a photo of the book cover that Yulene shared with us on our Instagram page, so go look at that. And we also talk about Enneagrams.
Yeah.
And Brett and I have since taken the Enneagram tests. And I am Enneagram type 3, the achiever, the same as Yulene. There's a lot of information out there about it. But the one sentence is focused on the presentation of success to attain validation.
Do you think it's accurate?
Terrific. Yeah, maybe. Do you want to share yours?
Yeah. I am Enneagram number 9, the adaptive peacemaker. It says they're motivated by a need to be settled and in harmony with the world.
Do you think that's accurate?
You know what? I think some of it's very accurate. And there are other parts where I was like, clearly I didn't answer some questions probably correctly. There were definitely parts of it that I was like, oh, that makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. That makes sense to me. So,
yeah.
It's really fascinating.
Something else that was cut from the episode is Yulene talked about even more rom-coms that she loves so much. So there's a little Easter egg at the end of the episode. So if you want to hear that, stick around. But otherwise, see you next week.
See you next week.
Have a great rest of your day. Bye.
Okay, I have one more. It's a period. It's a period film, so it's not really a rom-com, but it's called Far From the Madding Crowd,
and it's Thomas Hardy.
It's a Thomas Hardy novel, and it has Matthias Schoenaerts. That man knows how to look at someone.
I mean,
he's also in Rust and Bone, which is,
and he's in something else right now. What is it that he's
Matthias?
Yeah, I gotta look up. He is hot. I gotta look it up.
It's Keep really going. Good at the smolder. He's good. But that has one of my all-time favorite. So like the premise of Far From the Madding Crowd is he's a farmer and she is this kind of haughty girl. And he proposes to her and she's like, you couldn't handle me. And he's like, I disagree, but agree to disagree. And he's I have prospects. But then his prospects all fall apart because one of his overeager sheepdogs drives his entire flock of sheep over a cliff. And so he is like, he's invested in these sheep. And so now he has nothing. Anyway. Years pass. She inherits like some aunt's property, but there's a fire on her property and he's just passing through, but he helps save the property from a fire. And then he shows up and he's, wow, how our fortunes have changed. You're rich. I'm poor. And then he's like, I sure could use a job. And she's like, why don't you like tend? And so he does that and he's watching her get wooed by every man in the county. And it's awful for him, but he's just there. And she like fully marries another guy. And on the night of their wedding, there's a terrible storm and her husband is drunk. So she goes out there to secure the tarps on the bales of hay before the lightning strikes them. And Matthias Schoenaerts is also out there securing the tarp. And at one point, they're on top of a bale of hay. They're both pulling the tarps and there's so much sexual tension. And then at some point, she's like trying to drive him away. And they're wet. But then it gets to be too much and I have to leave. And she's like, no. Why would you ever leave me? And I would never leave you if you asked me to stay. And so she like asked him to stay. Oh God, I'm just thinking about it. And I don't know, her husband died. There's like a whole, and then people
I'm so excited to watch this.
The ending kiss is one of my favorite kisses because movie kisses, because I think they capture it in one shot, which is always nice because then you get that feeling of like in 24 frames per second, I'm living it rather than like it going too cutty. It's a good one, guys. It's a good one. Far From the Madding Crowd.